Hello, listeners. Welcome to Western Section Podcasts, the podcast for wildlifers. I am your host, workshop manager Ivan Parr, and I'm here with David and Jiza Nico. Welcome.
Hello, Ivan. It's good to be here.
Thanks, Ivan.
Hello. So, David and Jiza are here for our Section Authors series. They are the authors of the children's book series Bringing National Parks to Life, which has the goal of increasing awareness about endangered wildlife in national parks. So far, the series consists of Fish in the Desert, about the desert pupfish, Frogs on the Mountain, about the Sierra Nevada mountain yellow-legged frog, and Fishers in the Forest, about fishers in Sequoia and Kings Canyon. David and Jiza, your books have won several awards, including first place of the Little Peeps Chanticleer International Book Awards and the Purple Dragonfly Book Awards. You received 5 stars in the Reader's Favorite Awards. One of your books was an Ian Book of the Year winner, and one of them was a finalist in the Reader's Choice and Forward Indies Awards. Not to mention, they made it on the Green Earth Book 2025 and 2026 recommended reading lists. However, before we take a deep dive into your highly decorated series, we have 3 standard questions to ask you. Are you ready?
We're ready.
All right. So, both of you, what is your favorite animal?
Oh, my favorite animal? I don't know. The last one I saw?
The last one you saw?
Yeah, it could have been my dog or somebody else's dog, or you know, I don't know. I like all animals, and I can't get over how adorable like domesticated pets are. Yeah, okay. There's an evolutionary argument for it. They get so cute so that we feed them, but like I don't understand why raccoons and skunks and other animals are so adorable to humans, like, but I love them all. They're great.
I love that answer. It's sort of the opposite of what Joel Sartori says. You know, Joel Sartori, who does photo arc with National Geographic, he always says his favorite animal is the next one he's going to see.
That's a good answer.
What about you, Jiza? What's your favorite animal?
It is so hard. This question is so hard for me. I mean, they're just like David said, they are all so cute, but I do have a special place in my heart for raccoons, just in the way they use their little, you know, hands. I also love tortoises and just how slow they are and just, you know, the way they move. They're just so cute. And I think, well, I'm getting ahead of ourselves, but in studying them to write our next book, it's been really just fun learning even more about them. And there was a place in one of the illustrations, my favorite illustration in the book, where Jeff Alvarez was like, hey, you forgot the nostrils. The illustrator forgot the nostrils. And I just think it's the cutest picture ever. Of the desert tortoise. So, you know, those two are top on my list, but I could go on and on about others that I like.
I'm glad both of you mentioned raccoon. And I'm sorry that Lizzie isn't here, because she and I have this ongoing debate over whether raccoons are cute, or more specifically, whether or not raccoons are cuter than coatis, which I think definitely they are.
I would agree with that.
Wait, did you say koala or coati?
Coati.
I don't know what a coati is.
Oh, that'll be the next pick after this one. Yeah. Coatis in the rainforest. All right. That was only 1 question.
One way to go.
The next standard question was, what was your first job? This could be your first ever job.
Well, I've been working since I was 11. I was 11 years old and I had a paper route back in Detroit, Michigan. Riding my bike, awesome papers on people's porches, just like the video game that they came out with later.
Wow,
I had that job before the video game existed, so that's how old I am.
I don't even know what video game this is, but I love the imagining this. I've always wondered, you know, what would happen if you accidentally like hit it into the window, or you know, hit somebody's cat or something.
That is the whole premise of the video game.
Oh, is it?
It was a video game called Paperboy, and you know, you'd ride up the street and you'd toss things, and sometimes you'd get points for hitting cats. You'd lose points for hitting windows, and you get a more point. It's for hitting the mailbox, and you just ride up the street doing that.
Huh.
But we used to play that a lot when I was older, as a teenager.
This was in real life, not as a video game.
Yeah, correct.
So you would actually deliberately hit cats with newspapers.
Well, this was back in the early to mid 80s, so I don't feel like there was a lot of cats in my neighborhood. It was Detroit, so it was very wintry kind of town, and so not a lot of cats, not a lot of outdoor cats in my neighborhood to target. So,
well, that's an excellent first job. What about you, Jiza?
You know, I can't remember if it was babysitting, or I also did this I worked at a hop. Oh, well, I volunteered at the hospital as a candy striper. And then after that, I had a job on like a heart research project where I was scheduling patients.
So,
what I really want to talk. Oh, go ahead.
You just casually threw that in there. So you were a candy striper and then you worked on heart research?
No.
Were these connected in any way?
No, there was a heart.
Was one the result of the other?
No, it was a project where I was like the scheduler for these patients to come in to, I don't know, somehow get monitored for this research project. I can't really remember the details about it, but I think it was a woman's research heart project. But I wasn't one of the research people. I just scheduled people, patients. But what I want to talk about is my first college job, which was at Blockbuster Video, which is where I met David.
So
that is a true statement.
Blockbuster Video. Now, if anything, no offense, but isn't it sad that there's a finite point in time in which no one will ever meet their spouse at Blockbuster Video?
That's right. And we happen to both work there. But like, I think people may have met there just like, you know, maybe they were looking in at a movie and, you know, maybe
at a romantic comedy.
Exactly.
two people.
And there was only one copy left and they had to rent it together to be able to watch it.
But we're going to change that to your origin.
You should write
story.
A movie.
But where are they going to promote it? Right. So what did you were both working Blockbuster. What jobs did you have there? David was delivering papers there.
Well, you know, the Blockbuster job was 7 or 8 on my employment history list by that point. I was just out of high school and working at Blockbuster in my hometown where I was going to a junior college. And then I transferred to a college in Chicago. And then they believed Blockbuster had just gone corporate. So all the branches were corporately owned and I could just transfer to another store in Chicago. And then they were nice enough to promote me to assistant manager so I could actually pay my rent. And then Jisa got hired at the store I was working at as a freshman at her university. And the rest, as we say, is history.
Yeah, I was just in it really for the 5 free movies a week. Ivan, I could care less about anything else, really.
You want it, Frank? You
want it.
Right. Oh, wow. You wanted 5 free movies and you got a husband.
Exactly.
What a deal.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Our final standard question is, what was one piece of advice that you've received during your career that you'd like to share with all of our members?
Well, so my first professional job was a teacher. You know, that's what I went to school for, and that's what I've been trained and have been doing for the last 25 plus years. And the first year that I was teaching in public school in Santa Monica, I became friends with a very wise speech pathologist who worked with several of my students because I was in a special day class. And she said to me that I shouldn't wait to take vacations and have fun until I retired, that I should do it throughout my whole life. She had lost her husband young. He had retired. She was a few years away from retiring, and she was so thankful that she took all the ski trips and all the vacations before retirement, or else she wouldn't have had those memories with her family. And so I took that to heart. And every time we had a winter break, a summer break, a spring break, we usually were at the national parks.
So you hear that, members who get offended whenever I take a vacation? This is good advice. I am just following great advice.
Think it's very good advice.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm going to heed that advice.
Yes, you need to.
I will. Dave, what have you got?
Well, the best advice I ever got was not in a professional setting, but it has helped me throughout my professional years. It was from my older brother, Jim. And it's kind of funny because Jim was a very cool and laid-back guy, and I was not. I was very hyper and high strung and, anxious about stuff. And I remember I was in Cub Scouts, a preamble to Boy Scouts, and we were doing the soapbox derby race with the little wooden cars that you'd make. And every time a race would complete, he would take me aside and be like, "Will you calm down?" Because I'd be had handfuls of hair on my head, in my hands, like waiting to see who would win and whatever. And then he really pointed it up the next week when we got all the film developed, and he was showing me pictures of myself and how crazy I looked next to my opponent, who was just standing there, like just watching the race normally. And he's like, "You have got to learn to calm down, because you this does not serve either how you look or how you behave. So to take a chill." And so I've tried to kind of model my life after not being so tense or high strung and try to keep a cool, even keel about myself.
That's also brilliant advice that, it's so easy to get worked up about these things that in the long run don't matter. And even, now that we're adults and everything matters, money, work, your reputation, all of these things, sometimes it's just better to take a deep breath and step back and look at yourself and see
Right.
if you're
I
tensing
was
up.
always envious of the people that seemed to have it naturally, because I was always feeling like I was suppressing it. And some people would just kind of glide, and I'd be like, "Okay, I'm gliding as well, but."
You know what's funny, Ivan, is David is so laid back. So it's always,
Well, he took the advice.
he
That's
really
master.
did. I mean, I'm the one now. It's like we're opposite in that way. Like I'm the one who's like, type A, and he's like totally laid back. Everything is fine. Nothing ruffles his feathers.
Well, he listened to his
But you
brother
look
Jim.
great doing it. I was a crazy person. Like it's like captured on film with me being crazy.
I gotta see that.
We need some pictures of this. It's funny you mentioned the Boy Scout like derbies, because we had something similar where we would carve these race cars out of wood and put wheels on them and then race them down like rain gutters, and whoever's was like the fastest won the prize. So my friend, I won't say his name, but he would win every year this race. And the thing was is that we would all line up our cars and they would be weighed by two impartial people. And if they were if they were too heavy, then they would drill a hole into your car to make them weigh less. Of course, these two impartial people with the drills were his mother and his uncle. And so, you know, it was always, you know, kind of suspicious that year after year, he always won.
Yeah. I had a different experience with that whole program in the Boy Scouts was because I'm from Detroit. And out of a city of automotive engineers, my dad was the accountant. So I never even placed the cars that I would make. My dad literally whittled with his knife and then was like, here you go, put wheels on it. Where other kids' dads are like shaping it in wind test tunnels and waxing the wheels and putting a high gloss sheen of paint on it, like all of the added engineering to put into those things they had.
Are you sure there's the ones that didn't need to chill?
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was going to say. As a teacher, what's the point of the parents doing, making it, like, and then having the kids just race it? The fun is the kids should be making it and thinking about the design.
Agreed.
Parents these days. Oh, man, we haven't even gotten to the meat of this interview. I always have so much fun talking to you guys. Would you be willing to give our audience a brief overview of who you are and how your journey began to becoming authors? I mean, the funny thing is we tell your story in this nonlinear fashion, starting with all the awards that you make, then how you met, and now, you know, how this project began. But, you know, the audience knows that you're successful. What's the story?
The story is kind of accidental authors, really. I'm never planned on being an author or writing any sort of book whatsoever.
You realize the stereotypical monkey, you were just banging away at a typewriter and then, oh, wait, I wrote something brilliant.
How did this happen? No, I've worked in information technology for 12 years and in film production 12 or 13 years before that. I was an office guy. I was sitting at my keyboard doing officey things, not writing stories. And Gisa, I always thought, would make a great children's book author. She was a teacher and whatnot, of young kids. And we just happened to be out camping during COVID because it was one of the only activities we were allowed to go out and do. And we ended up going to Death Valley. And that story has a little bit of a preamble as well, because also during COVID, Gisa had to move her preschool profession from in-person to online. And so we started doing live sessions with the kids, but we also started producing YouTube videos for them to watch throughout the week. And then as we started to take these little weekend vacations to national parks, because it was the only thing we could do, we started recording those as well as additional content for the preschoolers. And one of the segments in the videos we would do in the beginning of each video, Gisa would pick out the books that she chose to take on that particular trip. So when we went to Death Valley, we did the whole thing. We picked out the books, we saw the things, but while we were there, we discovered the pupfish. And we were like, wow, these are great. This is terrific. We learned all about them. And it was a really sincere, fun adventure of discovering something new. And something fairly remarkable, in my opinion, because Death Valley is the hottest, driest place on Earth. And yet it has this species of fish that has lived there for over 20,000 years, which is insane. And so while we're there, we discovered this fish, we learned all about them, and we went to find a book about them. And it just didn't exist. We couldn't find anything. And then we started talking to people at the national park and the wildlife refuge. And they're like, no, nobody's ever written a book about the pupfish. So I kind of nudged Jason and said, maybe we should write a book about the pupfish. She was like, nah, not interested. But then, you know, we talked to more people and they're like, no, we could really use a book in here. So we kind of got a gentle arm twisting and wrote our first book. And we enjoyed it so much. We're like, could we make this into a series? And then we just started doing it. And the more we did it, the more we enjoyed it. So it's been a lot of fun, and it's very rewarding to do.
And Gisa, what was the moment that made you change your mind?
Well, I'll tell you, Ivan, it was Delmont at Ash Meadows Wildlife Refuge, because I told David, I'm not writing a book. Like, I'm not a writer. I've got so much on my plate trying to teach little babies on the screen. I wanted a book. Every place we went, we would purchase a book to bring back to the classroom, of all our travels. But when Delma said, we really kind of need one for when kids come through on field trips, I was like, really? Don't tell me that, because now I'm gonna have to do it. So yeah, that was the point where I was like, okay, I'm really gonna investigate this to see if this is possible. What's the cost of this? What's the process of this? How are we gonna find an illustrator? All of that. But that after the conversation with her, that's when I really was like, okay, I will do my due diligence to investigate this. I do want to say there is another pupfish book that was published the same month in the same year as
What?
us. Yes, there is. It is a great, it's complementary to our book. It takes place in the Owens Valley. It's about the Owens Valley
You're
pupfish,
kidding.
and it's called Pupfish Hero, and it is about Phil Pister, who single-handedly saved the Owens Valley
Yeah.
pupfish in buckets.
Buckets, yeah.
So it's more about him than the pupfish. And of course, it's a totally different, area. Like we focused on the Death Valley area and the pupfish there. But it's great because there are no other books that I know of that are published on the pupfish. There was a coloring book years ago that's out of print. I couldn't find anything. There's one like blurb in an endangered species book, but like that's it.
So, I mean, the significance here, there's two things that I pick up on. One is that you will do anything for your students.
Yes, that is true.
Yes.
That
And
is true.
that's the second thing is that, Delma, I'm assuming, is this a ranger or a park aide or?
I'm not sure if she's a volunteer there. She's there all the time. She works at the front desk of Ash Meadows Wildlife Refuge, and like the gift shop is
So maybe
right next to.
she's a
Yeah. So
fish and
she's in
wildlife
charge.
service person.
Yeah, she's in charge of like the bookshop, although, David Blacker is her boss who work, he manages both at Death Valley Gift Shop and Ash Meadows Gift Shop. So
So, I guess the point is that, one little guilt-trippy sentence,
yes.
and then, 2 years later, and
Very susceptible to guilt tripping sentences.
you've won like 12 different top-notch awards.
Yeah,
Yeah.
I'll do just about anything for kiddos. So,
And
yeah, it's
they must love it. They must be very proud that their teacher is a best-selling author. So that's the story of how you did the first one. What made you decide it was going to be a series? Just
Well, the
how
first
much fun you've had.
we had growing pains. Like, to be honest, there were a lot of growing pains with the first book. And during the process, I was loving it and having fun, but there were also things that were hard, right? And I was like, I don't know. I don't know if Dave and I are going to be able to do this again. But then we pulled it off, and we just, it was well received by, young children. And we thought there are other animals that kids don't know about, there, I could not find one Pacific Fisher book ever published. The mountain yellow-legged frogs, yeah, it's a frog, and there are a lot of books about frogs, but like this one had a really interesting story. And all of them, in all our books in the series, the through line is that everything is connected, right? So these animals, though they may be small, may seem, especially the pupfish, like 2 inches, may seem insignificant, but if they are not there, it impacts the whole ecosystem. And so that's kind of like the through line of all of our all of the books in the series. And then there's tons of, great ecology. And so we just thought, I don't know, it put us on a mission. Like, we need to start teaching kiddos at a very young age to appreciate nature, that everything in nature is important and everything is connected. The plants, the animals, the small insects, everything is connected. And, just teaching preschool for 18 years, that was kind of my mission in also having kids get along. Like, there are so many conflicts, right? Like, so many conflicts right now amongst adults, in different countries. And I thought, well, if we can start teaching community from a very young age, we can actually, I think, make an impact. And so it was the same thing with this book series. If we could get kiddos to appreciate and to get out in nature and see nature everywhere, they don't have to be at a national park. And so, yeah, that was our mission. And then I started going in and doing these, read alouds and having conversations in elementary school. And the elementary schools around us, a lot of the kiddos, one of the first things I ask is, have you ever been to a national park, a state park? And no hands, right? And so what a beautiful way to introduce children to these places that right now they may not be able to get to, but maybe it'll plant a seed for when they can get to one, or just local parks, just that appreciation and conservation and stewardship.
So, would you say that your first goal is looking forward to the future where the next generation learns to conserve, wild lands? Or is the first goal, the development of these children and what they can learn from national parks?
I think it's both. And I think I mean, we're in a different time now than when we started writing these books, in 2020. Well, the first one we started to write it in 2022. But national parks are under attack right now. So of course, we want these kiddos to see why it's important to preserve these spaces, and again, how everything is connected. But in speaking with all of you wonderful scientists, I realized we need to grow the next generation of scientists and conservationists, right? And citizens that are going to really preserve these for generations to come. These wild places. And so yeah, it's both, Ivan.
What makes you choose one species or another? We've heard the story of the pupfish, what inspired frogs and then Fisher
Yeah,
and
the frogs was just kind of kismet. It happened. We loved them and it just kind of unfolded. The frogs were kind of funny because we were looking for an animal in a park that was visited regularly that people would have a connection with, and we remembered a visit to to a park where we just set up our campsite and we were going to sleep, and then we just heard this croaking near the water, and it kind of woke up our daughter. And we're like, don't worry, it's just frogs, go back to sleep. And when we decided on the mountain yellow-legged frogs to write about, that's kind of how we opened the book with, this family settling into their campsite and then going off to sleep and then hearing this croak at night and her, being woken up by it and then immediately in the morning wanting to go down to the water and, find out what was making all this noise. So it was interesting, and then learning about the mountain yellow lake frogs and how close they came to being completely extinct, and the way that scientists and
people of Yosemite brought them back was kind of remarkable to learn, and it was really fun adding those elements to the book as well.
Yeah, and we were camping in right outside of Kings Canyon when that happened
Correct.
with the frogs. And we were gonna put all three, we were gonna try to do all three parks in the Sierras, but it was just too much to try to cram into a children's picture book. And so we landed on Yosemite, but then we picked up Sequoia and Kings Canyon with the Fishers. And the Fishers, I was talking to someone at the park and they were like, "You're going to start hearing more about the Fishers." I was like, "Really? What is a Fisher?" And so I did some research. And then David and Andy had gone to do research up in Tuolumne Meadows, with the with the Mountain Yellow Lake frogs.
Andy is the illustrator.
Andy is our
Correct.
illustrator. Yes. And then they came back with pictures of like these footprints and I thought also a fisher, but they weren't sure what it was. And I was like, "You guys."
We were pretty sure it was a fisher that we saw, because we were there, we were researching frogs, we were trying to get pictures of frogs and walking around these meadows, and we were at a rise in hillside or mountain that was facing north, so it had still a lot of snow cover on it. And as we were approaching it, a yay big black furry animal crawled out of a space and then ran straight up this slope, and it happened so fast. We were like, what was that? Was that a badger, a fisher? And we kind of settled on the fact that we thought it was a fisher, and I was so bummed I could not get a photo of it while it was happening, because the interaction of it was so fast. But we retraced our steps and found footprints in the snow of it, so we took reference photos of that. But it was kind of funny when Jesus said to me, "Oh, I think we should do our next book on the fisher," and I was like, "We saw one of those." It was just kind of interesting.
Yeah, and I thought that was a sign too when he was like, "Wait, we I think Andy and I saw one." And I was like, "Okay, it's a sign. Let's do it." So that's how
And
that happened.
again, one of the aspects of the book is how elusive fishers are from being seen. They're very stealthy creatures, so they don't come out in the open. They don't interact. They're very difficult to see. So the fact that we saw one was exciting, and we kind of wrote that into what Adele's mission was on this camping trip. She had learned something about Pacific creatures in school, so she specifically wanted to see if she could see one on this particular trip that I took.
So each of the stories is focused on this family, the mom, dad, and a little girl named Adele. And your family, you have one daughter. Is Adele based on your daughter?
Yeah, our daughter's name is Adele. We don't do a whole lot of reaching for hugely creative things. We pluck the things that are right next to us for the most part. Because we have future books where mom and dad are not on the camping trip, but other families are, and we just pull names from those family members too. So
Is
yeah,
there like do your family friends sort of vie for who gets the mention?
no, but
No, not yet.
our niece's daughter was very excited that one of the rangers' names was her name, Grace. But we, one of the questions that we get asked a lot from adults and children alike are, "Oh, did your daughter really break her leg?" Because in the Death Valley story, she was on crutches. And I said, "No, our daughter never played soccer, and no, she never broke her leg." So there's a lot of fictional elements within the information that's shared. But like David shared, yes, we did hear croaking at night, and she's a city girl, so she had never heard that before. So she was like, "What's that?"
And so, how does Adele like being portrayed in this book series?
Well, to be
It's a
honest.
developing, reaction to it. At
To
first,
be
she's
honest.
not too keen on it.
Exactly. She was actually kind of angry about it. It was like, why are you doing this? And then Ivan, when she saw the reaction that people really liked to the stories after the second one, she was like, wow, you guys are really like doing this. And she, you know, she's a teen now, and she likes it now. She actually has a positive attitude towards it, but that wasn't the case in the beginning.
So you had the foresight to know, okay, well, she doesn't like it, but we're gonna go through with it anyway, and it's gonna work out. One day you'll thank us.
Yeah, that's what we get with age and wisdom. We know she'll develop into like coming around.
I am curious, you know, what other feedback have you gotten from other children? Do you know, when you go to the national parks, children run up to you with their books and want an autograph.
Well, down, oh, well, you know, I don't think we're that big yet. But Dalma did tell me that before Death Valley started carrying it, Dalma told me she had seen like at least four kids come in with the book, and she's like, I don't know where they're getting it from, but they are coming in with the book. So that David and I high-fived each other, because it's like that was our first purpose, was like get the kids excited that they want to go see these pupfish, right? So that was exciting to hear. And then I just got an email like a couple weeks ago from a family that said that their kiddo like wants to read Pupfish. They have all three books, wants to read Pupfish every single night. And I was like, I'm sorry to the parents because they must be so sick of it, but want us to read it every night. They went on a camping trip, their very first camping trip locally. And he was like, Mama, a Pupfish book. He's 3 years old. He's about to be four. And she, by the time she grabbed it out of the bag, he was asleep. He woke up at 3 a.m. and was like, you never read me the Pupfish book. So she had to read the Pupfish book in their tent at 3 a.m., which just tickled us. Like we were just laughing. Another thing I wanted to share is we were asked to go to an AP environmental science classroom in high school. And when the teacher asked me, I said, you know, this is a picture book. I don't know if high schoolers are really going to received this very well. And she's like, no, you know, a lot of the concepts in this are like ecology concepts that we cover. And so like food chains and, you know, food webs and all that, pesticides. And so I did. I went in, and they really did. They paid attention. I kind of taught them why we started this, how to kind of blend science with art. Which is what this teacher was hoping I would do, and just took them through the whole process of how we made the book.
Well,
I do have to add that that was my daughter's high school that this happened at, and she
no,
was not happy
no, no, no. This
that.
was actually not that. That this was a different high
Oh.
school with a teacher that I just met at REI when I was selling.
So
I
the
did
high school
career day at
careers.
Adele's school, yeah, and she was not happy about
Careers,
that.
career day at Adele School did not go over well with Adele.
With Adele, but I
All
think the kids
right.
enjoyed it.
Yeah.
It's the job of parents to embarrass their children.
Exactly.
But you bring up an interesting point, because even though these are children's books, there are kind of adult concepts in them, at least scientifically adult concepts. You have, you know, the frog is one of the main characters of the story, and no spoilers, but you know, not everything that happens to the frog is good for the frog.
Correct.
And there's a scene of Amplexus. You know, what are sort of the reactions from parents or children about these kind of heavier concepts? Or
most,
heavier or more grown-up concepts, maybe I should say.
yeah, most of
Well,
the feedback.
that's all kind of by design, at least in the writing of it. We didn't want to make a cutesy, rhymy, fun, you know,
we just wanted it to be a story. And if the story was good and people liked it, then we could put on all these educational things about it as well. Like I've always felt that reading to young kids, the content of what you're reading them doesn't matter all that much, is that you're doing it as a family. You're sitting down with them at night and reading to them at night. You could be reading anything almost, but if they get used to that, they begin to enjoy the love of reading as well. So it was like, I didn't want to make just a cutesy toddler type of book. I wanted to make a book that felt real and felt, you know,
yeah,
connected to stuff.
Yeah, where kids could really learn real. Yeah, we didn't want to talk down to kiddos because right. David, mm-hmm. you know, was in the he was always behind the scenes in the preschool, right? And he saw how much these kiddos just absorbed, and with our own daughter. So most of the feedback we get, Ivan, is that they people like that we use real words, right? We use real vocabulary words, you know, and we don't shy away from real concepts. And I think that we do a pretty good job of bringing it down to a level where mm-hmm. kiddos can understand and ask more questions and get curious about the information. So
what do you think makes a child pull the book off a shelf? Because I noticed that, and by notice, I might have a small collection of the little plushies that come with the book. And to be perfectly honest, I met you, Jisa, because I saw you were selling plushies of Pupfish, and that blew my mind that such a thing existed. And that's what got me to come over to your table and have a conversation. And I'm not ashamed to admit that either. Are you, you know, are these little plushies like your greatest advertising? What, you know, how do they play a role in this?
It's mixed. So the reason why we developed them is because a lot of the times kids love, like when I was teaching, I always used concrete, right, to teach. So like if I was reading a story, I would either, sometimes I would pull things that would be in the story for kids to do like a mystery bag so that they could like actually hold some of the things that were going to be in the story. And I still do that now with these books. You know, if there's a specific tree that we mention, I'll have a little plastic replica. If there's a pine cone, I'll have a real pine cone in there. And I have some of the animals that they're going to see in there so that they pull them out. And we talk about them before we even get started with the story. So and the other thing a lot of younger elementary school teachers also do is they have reading buddies, or book buddies. So the child will practice their reading to a stuffed animal, right? So that was kind of like our reasoning for having them. And I have a lot of animal puppets and a lot of little animal plastic figurines that I would use in teaching. So it kind of like an educational tool. They are well received. I mean, you scientists really love them. Mm-hmm. Young kids want them. A lot of the times the parents are like, no, you have too many stuffies. That's what I hear lately. No, you have too many stuffies, but I'll buy you the book. And personally, I get excited about like, oh, good, buy the book. Because when the kiddos just want the stuffies, and this is also the thing, like it always bothered me when we would be in a gift shop, you know, National Park gift shop or wherever, zoo gift shop. And they had the plushies, but they didn't have information about the animals, because I always wanted the book to go along with the plushie, because I think the important part is that the kiddos are learning, like, okay, well, here's a frog, but like, what's special about this frog? Like, you know, and that could be infused in their play. If they have information, then they can be, you know, acting, you know, with the frog. Yeah, with real information about that frog. So, yeah. That's why.
Uh-oh, Froggy getting chytrid. Better take him to the doctor.
Exactly. And we use that word, the word in our book.
What have you learned from the kids that goes into your writing?
Well, definitely that they want information, that they love to learn. And if you start reading, this goes back to what David said. And, David, I have tons of pictures of David reading to our kid, our little baby Adele, before she could understand anything, even in a board book, right? Even in a simple book. Like from the time she was born, he was reading to her. And if you start to read to kiddos at an early age, they do that warm and fuzzy, like sitting on a family member's lap, and they start to crave books, and they actually want to sit there and listen to stories, and that helps their attention span. And so one of the hardest things, one of the hardest questions I get from parents is, well, what age is this for? Because when you look at the books, you're like, oh wait, these vocabulary words are really like way old for way older kiddos. But like it's hard for me because I know at preschool the students would sit for like at least a half hour. They just loved to listen to books. But that was because they were used to us doing that in the classroom. So I've learned that you can actually put a lot of information into a book, and real information, and kiddos are sponges, and that they will get curious. They will ask more questions than what the information you've even put in the book, and that they can handle that.
One interesting question that I'm assuming you might get from biologists is, say, in Frogs in the Mountain, there is a scene where Grace, the ranger, and Adele commit a federal crime. How have you had to deal with that question yet? About, picking up animals in national parks?
Hey, am I going to throw Rob Grasso onto the bus here?
I'll run it past him before we air this.
So I asked Rob, I said, hey, we kind of want like Grace to hand the frog to Adele and have her like, handle the frog. And he's like, if a kid can't hold a frog, then what's the point of anything? What's the point of all this? And I was like, well, that's how I feel, but like, I just wanted to make sure that that was kosher, right? So I think in our next book, Tortoises on the Trail, there's another handling situation because the tortoise is on the street, right? And this is a real problem that happens. And the kids don't handle the tortoise, but the ranger does. And the ranger teaches the kiddos what to do if they do see a tortoise that could be endangered, crossing the road, including putting on gloves or using a blanket, and getting it across. So, and in the back of all of our books, we specifically, mention, don't release pets, don't release domesticated pets out, and don't take any species home. Don't take any animals home with you. So we hope that that message comes across, and throughout every book, the respect for the environment and the animals, I think it's a pretty strong message.
Right. And I mean, it sounds like you are involving people who work at these parks. I'm assuming that they're reading your books and giving you thumbs up. And you're also, you mentioned Jeff Alvarez, you're getting experts to review him.
So, Jeff Alvarez worked on tortoises and is going to work on our future books with us as well. And he did review the frogs, but after the fact. And he also reviewed the fishers after the fact too. And there were really great suggestions that he made, that when we reprint, we will add, fix some of the little, I guess, mistakes that he's always so good. You know, he's like, this isn't necessarily wrong. It's just that you wouldn't see this, you know, typically. He's so sweet to us.
Yeah,
But
he's great.
Yeah,
yeah, but we
I can
are
hear him
gonna
saying that.
we want everything to be super, super, super accurate. So we are going to fix those little nuanced things.
That's beautiful. And what about your relationship with national parks? Do you get calls from different parks? Hey, you gave one to Death Valley in Yosemite. Can you do us next?
We wish. We're not there yet, but maybe one day we'll have parks buying for us to create a book for their park. But no, it's still like, hey, would you like to read our book? Would you like to carry it in your shop? Would you like to? And they're like, bip, bip, bip.
We're small potatoes. The
Yeah.
books are the Fish in the Desert book is both at Ash Meadows Wildlife Refuge along with Death Valley.
And just to toot our own horn, they've had to reorder it more than once. So they are selling there.
They are selling, and I think they're
Those
selling pretty well. Yeah.
pupfish books are moving out of those gift shops, which we think is wonderful.
Yes. And we did, Ivan, get asked to join Ash Meadows for their junior wildlife refuge day. And that was so fun. So I got to read the Pupfish book aloud to the kiddos and sign books at the wildlife refuge, junior wildlife refuge day. And then I was chatting with someone at Desert Wildlife Refuge, and they're like, oh, you're doing Ash Meadows? Well, while you're out here, will you come and, you know, do something with us? So I also did a reading and some crafts with the kiddos there. So, you know, slowly, but we love this kind of stuff. So we hope that there'll be more invitations.
I remember when I was a kid, I went to a children's book fair and I got a book on rattlesnakes. And the authors of all these books were supposed to be there. And I kept asking, where is this author? And they kept telling me, oh, she's not here yet. I don't know if she's coming. I don't know if she's coming. And I was really disappointed because, you know, all these other kids are getting their books signed. And then
Yeah.
just before we left, somebody came up to my dad and said, oh, that author just arrived. And I walked into the room where she was waiting, and she mirrored the expression that was on my face when I saw that she was actually there. She opened up her mouth and made, like, you know, her eyes like big and wide, because that's apparently what I did when I saw that she was actually, you know, in person. So that just, you know, this is making me remember that moment. And I have
That is so
to
heartwarming.
that is the best thing I've heard all day.
I
I could
mean,
picture little Ivan just waving to get his snake book signed.
you must get that too, though, from kids who habitually who need to read, you know, the Pupfish book every night.
Yeah, we do. We definitely have some fans, and it is really heartwarming. I mean, it's undescribable just how it makes us feel. Like we just love it. Like I don't know how, there aren't like words to tell you like how heartwarming it really is for us when a kid brings up a book, you know, and wants it signed. And even shops, we always give the option, you know, like do you want us to sign them before we send them? And they're like, oh, would you? And it's like, that's one of my favorite things to do. Like I love doing that, you know.
Yeah.
I like getting signatures from the authors that I like too, you know. And I know my daughter loved it too. So it's special. It's just special.
That's wonderful. A minute ago, you mentioned, you know, Rob's quote about, you know, if kids can't handle frogs, what's the point? I'm assuming your own childhoods played importance in creating the series, you know. Did you grow up catching animals? What was your relationship with animals in the national parks growing up?
Well, to be completely honest, I don't think I stepped foot in a national park until I was an adult. But I did grow up in Southeast Michigan, which is very rural, very fun place to grow up. There are no national parks there, but we did have, fishing trips and wildlife excursions. Like I said, I was in the Cub Scouts. We would go out on, trips to find frogs and snakes and turtles and all sorts of things. And those were very shaping my view of the outdoors and how to behave there and how to, interact with nature and that sort of thing.
Wow, you hadn't been to a national park until you were an adult. What can you describe the experience of first setting foot into a national park, not knowing that you would write a book series on them?
Well, that's very true. I'm trying to think because the first time I went was with Jisa and Adele, and I'm trying to think what was our very first park? Was it Sequoia?
With Adele, no, with I can't remember when you and I first went. I think we went to one before Adele. No, with Adele, we went to Mendenhall Glacier. That's where we first discovered the Junior Ranger program.
That's true.
And that is not a national park, but like, national public lands, right?
Right.
And we did a lot of public lands in that on that Alaska trip. But we've also, but we had a yearly summer camping trip in Kings Canyon. So, and that Sequoia and Kings Canyon are Adele's
Yeah,
favorite national parks. I cannot
they're
remember
mine
the
too.
first one you and I went to, but Ivan, I did not grow up. I grew up in urban, like urban and suburban Chicago. And same, like Illinois doesn't have a national park. But my first national park I went to was in college. It was Yosemite. And I went by myself. I met a mom and her daughter at a in San Francisco at a youth hostel, and they were going to Yosemite, and they took me along with them. And that's
Some would say
something.
kidnapped, but no.
Right.
I think that's part of all this too, right? Like we didn't, and I tell kids this when there's a room full of kiddos in, fourth and fifth grade that haven't been yet. And I say, I never went to a national park either when I was younger. Now the Indiana Dunes, right? But back then it wasn't designated national lands. So, you could technically say that because we would go to the dunes all the time. But I never went to a designated national park when I was younger. And so it's never too late, right? That's what I tell them. They're there and they're special places, and it's never too late to go and visit and explore.
Well, it may be too late, as a matter of fact.
Well,
Well,
you're right. You know what? I try to be hopeful.
yeah,
I
I
think
think cooler heads will prevail eventually, but.
it's a bipartisan, right? It's like everyone loves the parks. They are the United States treasures. And I am hoping that we preserve them, and that's why we need to get kids to understand, why they're so important.
Yeah. And in a world where we're constantly intentionally being divided amongst each other, you go to a park and you'll find everybody there enjoying it the same way, no matter what side of the spectrum they fall on, of the spectrums that we're supposed to dislike about each other. And none of that matters. You just go and enjoy nature and be out in it. And it's it if there is a uniting factor in this country of ours, the parks is definitely at the top of that list.
Yeah, agree. Yeah. So, fingers crossed. I do still think that we need the education, right? Like, because this is the example I always use, Ivan, is that oh, well, if you don't know better, right? If you've never been, and there's so many acres of this national park. So what's giving a little bit to the miners or a little bit to the oil, the people who want to drill for oil. But if they actually get to go there and see the pristine beauty and the importance and the uniqueness and why each park it's so you they're preserved for a reason, right? And they all of them have a different different spectacular things about them. And so that's what I think people need, and especially the youth, need to understand, is that even giving a small piece is a travesty. And they have to understand why they're important in order to then vote to keep them.
And are you in the series only? First of all, thank you for that answer. It's nice to hear, a message of hope and expectation that things will work out. We all
Yes, well.
love these protected lands. Are you only going to do national parks in this series? I know you snuck in Ash Meadows kind of under the blanket of Death Valley, but is the focus all national parks, no state or county?
I think so. I think we're going to stick with it for now. There are so many beautiful wild places. And, in chatting with you, and all your colleagues, we can be swayed, I think. Sometimes I come back and I'm like, oh, David, the Carrizo Plain. Oh, David, because you all are so passionate about the places you work. We're trying hard to stick to the national parks, but we do recognize that there are so many other lands that are special and need the protection as well.
I mean, even focusing on national parks, there's 63 of them.
There are.
So, do you plan to do?
I was just going to say, Ivan, that we can't write about all the national lands, and if our journey is an inspiration to others to write their own books on other national lands, then that would be a wonderful thing as well.
I'm
I mean,
sure
we're
it
a certain
will.
age right now, right, Ivan? We're not
We're
spring
no spring
chickens.
chickens.
And so if we do, it takes us about,
You're not.
9 months.
You're not old
We
either. You're perfectly normal aged.
are. We are. But if you think about 63 national parks, we have now published four. One every year, let's say. We'll be really old by the time we get through 63, right?
59 left to go. Yeah.
So what goes into picking and choosing is, I mean, I'm going to assume that you will live long enough to complete the entire series, but are you prioritizing ones over others?
I don't think we're prioritizing. We started in California. We live in California. Our, Tortoises takes place in California. Our next one will also be California, but after that, so number five will be California, number six will be out of state. And then we're probably going to come back to California and then go out of state again, but we're not sure. We kind of we have a loose plan.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I noticed a little bit of evasive maneuver there when you mentioned Ick 5. Okay. We know Fishers is on the market, and Tortoises is going to be coming out in August, right?
August, yes.
Tortoise
Yep,
is
it's out
on
in
the
the
trail.
printers right now.
I swear I saw you selling tortoises, at least the plushies.
We do have, yes, we did not make the plushies. We did make the plushies for the first two books, but the Fishers and the Tortoises, we found beautiful stuffies that were already made, so we are using those. We were selling the plushies, but we only had the we were only displaying the cover. I always let the science community know, the biology, the wildlife biologists know ahead of time. They get to see the cover first, before I announce it to our newsletter folks, who they get to see it way earlier than the general public. So that's kind of how we introduce things. But so I did have the cover of the book, but our books are, like David said, being printed as we speak.
Nice.
And we are taking pre-orders on the website as well.
Oh,
So
wonderful.
yes.
And remind the audience, what date they should expect to be able to receive their copy of Tortoises on the Trail.
Sometime in August. We have pre-sales, so if many people have pre-purchased and we have not forgotten about you, I have your information in a very safe place. And David will be shipping those out as soon. We literally get them and we like start working on the shipments that night. So you'll get them as soon as we get them.
August 2026, folks.
Yes.
I know, I can't wait for my Tortoises on the Trail book.
Yay.
You know, we just mentioned like 400 species of animals, and of course they can't all be main characters in your series, but you do pay homage to a lot of species, plants and animals in the ecosystems where Adele and her family visit. And in the back of these books, there are all these pictures of creatures with a little bit of natural history information that you're supposed to go back and find them in the pages. What inspired you to do that?
Well, there are so many animals in each of these ecosystems, and we wanted kiddos to see those animals and plants actually, and be familiar with them. And we thought it would be fun to have a little like have them camouflaged throughout the pages of the story, so kiddos can go back and go back into the story again to find them and hopefully, want to reread the book several times. And so David, well, Andy, our illustrator, he's a little naturalist himself. He's
Yeah.
constantly in the outdoors.
He's hardcore.
Yeah.
He's always going out on camping trips and being outdoors and being with nature, and he takes his research very seriously
Yeah,
and
no kidding.
loves what he does and how he does it. And the only time I got to see him research anything was when we took the camping trip to research the mountain yellow-legged frogs, and that was a great trip. It was fascinating to watch him work and shoot photographs and take notes, and we had a lot of fun on that trip.
Yeah, David, t tell them, share what you shared with me, like how he would go and he would touch like the plants and
Yeah, that was the thing. It was never one, he didn't focus on just the animals or just, stream beds or whatever. He would get down and touch plants that he hadn't seen before and try photographing them in different light, and he would just his natural curiosity about everything around him was really a lot of fun to observe. Because a lot of us can, we've gone on a hike and we'll just traipse through the trail trying to get from one point to another, and he is about being on that trail and seeing what's around him. It was a lot of fun to be with him and share that with him, because it was kind of incredible.
yeah, and I mean, you look at these books and the scenes that he's painting, and you feel like you're there. You recognize these places. How, I mean, it's so incredible that he's a part of this. He's really very essential to this. Was he a family friend? How did you actually meet him?
He is essential. Especially for a children's book, pictures are everything, right? If you don't have the pictures down, they're never going to get to the words. That's what draws kids in right away, are the pictures. It was a challenge to find him because, we don't know illustrators. We just so I have tons of books. I have a book collection, a children's book collection, because I've taught for over 25 years and I love children's books, and it's a little bit of a as David would say, a collection for me, because I love collecting them. And so I just went through books and I was shocked to see like how many books do not, I never really paid attention the way I was paying attention when I went through the books, tried to find an illustrator. David and I had a vision of having them look, everything look realistic because of our writing. It's, real science and real, stewardship and conservation and ecology. And so we wanted our pictures, our illustrations to look real but not boring. We wanted them to still be kid friendly. And so we started looking through all of our picture books, and I was shocked to see that there were not that many that matched the style that we had in our heads. So we came across one of Andy's books, and it was like, oh, this is perfect. We had reached out to other authors because I have like over 3,000 books. We had reached out to other authors in the meantime, but when we got to Andy's book, we were like, this is it. Like, this is really like what we need. We need him on our project.
And we don't have agents or managers or publishers or anything. And I think we found Andy on Facebook, like through social media, how we reached out to him.
I don't remember, David. I don't remember actually how I got his information. Yeah, it must have been. I can't remember how I got his information. I mean, obviously I had his name. It was in the book. But it must have been through social media. But somehow we got his phone number, and or no, you know what? Email. I emailed him at first, and then we had a conversation, and then it went from there.
Just cold call. Hey, we love your work. We'd love you to illustrate our book. And he didn't hang up on us immediately or delete our email. He just got back to us, and that was great.
Very kind. Very kind.
Amazing. Amazing. All right. I have one final question for you. So for Western Section members, our section is sort of built around this idea of servicing professionals and students. But so often we have members who ask what we can do to provide for our incoming generations. What do you think is the most important role that we professional biologists can play in the lives of our youngest protobiologists?
Oh, this is a very easy question for me to answer. And David, you can throw in your 2 cents as well. But I think having students see real life scientists who are doing the work, wildlife biologists who are out there and can come into a classroom and even half hour, and tell them about what you do. I mean, I think that is the most powerful. Even more than these books, to be honest, because what we're trying to do through these books is to show your role, right? Through the rangers. The rangers are always a wildlife biologist. They're a herpetologist, an aquatic ecologist, always a biologist. So I think just talking to them and sharing with them what you do, because I have told many wildlife biologists that your colleagues, that if I had exposure to any one of you, I would have probably gone into wildlife biology.
Wow, that's beautiful.
I am so just like, it's never too late.
I mean, you kind of are biologists. You're teaching about it, and it's clear that you do all this incredible research in order to create these books.
We do. We do, and you guys help us immensely. And but honestly, if I didn't even know what a wildlife biologist was, like I'd never come across a wildlife biologist. I never met one. I never saw one in action. Like I didn't even I didn't, I wouldn't have known what they did, right? Like, and I just think sharing that, whether it's through career day or just any time, really, I don't even think it needs to be a career day. I think that sharing what you do would inspire kiddos to want to explore more, and learn more about about biology and ecology.
I think we can do that. Thank you.
I do too.
Well, is it the Point Arena Mountain Beaver? All right. Thank you for tuning in to Western Section Podcasts. It has been a pleasure meeting this show's guests, Jiza and David Nico. We like to thank our Oversight Committee, Program Director Cynthia Perrine, and Project Manager Candace Renger, and our producer Brandon Noonan, and our Podcast Committee, Erica Walther, Elizabeth Meisman, and Ivan Parr. And to all of our members, please stay safe and healthy, and
be part of something wilder.